Members, the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform will come to order. We have a quorum present, so first order of business will be to move the minutes for March 30th, 2016. Do I have a motion to move the minutes?
Done.
Representative Franzen moves the minutes for March 30th, 2016. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Members, first bill of the day is Representative Albright's bill, House File 3241. And Representative Albright moves his bill, House File 3241, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Albright, to your bill.
Madam Chair and committee members, the House File 3241, which is before you this afternoon, really is a continuation of the theme that we heard last session with the grant program that provided much-needed additional emphasis for medical care providers from the doctor's perspective. But now, members, we need to follow through and take care of the grant program, which is much needed for the other healthcare providers, such as nurse practitioners, mental health professionals, and those of that same peer. That being said, this is a grant program that, as you see on page 2 in particular, in my opinion, provides what is necessary for a grant program to achieve its goal, with a program that is fairly robust in terms of who, the what, the how, and the when, the application process, which makes sure that we do not only visit upon the description of the problem, but have the grantee explain how they intend to go about providing for a solution to that. In addition to that, subdivision 4 actually speaks to the consideration the commissioner will undertake in terms of review of those, and then the accountability the commissioner can provide to those on an ongoing basis after the grant has been approved. I have Mr. Schoenbaum with me from MDH, if you have any questions for him as well, but I'm happy to stand for questions. Thank you.
Okay, and is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify to the bill? Not seeing any members' questions. Not seeing any questions. And Representative Albright, I'll say thank you for carrying this bill. This came out of the Healthcare Workforce Task Force as one of the initiatives that we wanted to see move forward, and so I appreciate your carrying the water and bringing it forward. And so not seeing Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if I could work with Representative Albright for an amendment, if it goes forward, to include clinical pharmacists training. They have a really good training program, and I think it would help with our opioid problem in Minnesota.
Madam Chair,
Representative Albright.
Schultz, I'm happy to take that under consideration. If you can buy the copy, I'll come to your office.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Albright. I think this is a much-needed thing. I'm looking at subdivision 4, the consideration, and I'm wondering, is it intended that with these criteria that there be some kind of ranking prioritization? I'm just wondering how the commissioner is supposed to figure out where the money would best be used, because I know that with this program, it's going to, you know, the resources, whatever we do in this area, the resources are never going to really be enough, and so there are going to have to be some tough priorities set, and somebody's going to get the money and somebody else isn't, and so could you just talk about that a little bit? I'm not really seeing anything that really tells them how to rank.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Liebling. I think in light of the technical nature of your question, I'm going to ask Mr. Schoenbaum to come down and address that.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Schoenbaum. If you could just introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Mark Schoenbaum from the Health Department, also serve as staff to the Legislative Healthcare Workforce Commission. It's been our privilege to do so. Representative Liebling, there is on line 313 mention of a relative score, which I think would give guidance to the department to attach values to the factors listed above in subdivision 4. Once that is done, the applications would, as noted, be placed in relative order, their budgets reviewed, and offers of grants made up to the amount of funds that were available.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Schoenbaum, so I guess there's sort of some procedure here that maybe is implied, that isn't entirely spelled out, maybe because the department does this in other cases, that they, I assume from this, that they kind of set up a ranking of, or some kind of weighting system for the various factors before the grant requests come in, and then they've got something to measure them against. Is that kind of how this works?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Representative Liebling, that is typically what is done. Some programs have a scoring system, such as a 100-point scoring system, built into statute itself. In some, there's more flexibility, as we have before us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Schoenbaum, for being here and for your work on the task force. Members, not seeing any further questions or comments, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 3241 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And Representative Albright, you have the next bill up on the agenda, which is House File 3199. Representative Albright moves House File 3199 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. We have the bill in front of us. And Representative Albright, I understand that you have an A2 amendment.
Madam Chair, yes, the A2 amendment. I'd like to move the A2 amendment in order to get the bill in the array that would be preferred by the agency.
Okay, so members, we will move, or excuse me, Representative Albright moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the order that he would like. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Albright, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this bill is the Department of Human Services bill. This is the bill's first hearing in the House, and I have completed my task of putting the A2 amendment on. After the brief presentation that I'm about to give you, this bill is going to civil law for some additional consideration. Just a little background in terms of what we're looking at today, members. Annually, the Minnesota Department of Human Services submits to the legislature a series of policy changes for our consideration. These ideas come to the department from a variety of sources, stakeholders that they have been working with, legislators, or from department staff. In this bill, some of the changes are broad policy changes. For example, existing standards for assertive community treatment, some of the changes to clarify past law changes that the department is having trouble implementing, like the corporate foster care moratorium exceptions, et al. Rather than presenting this bill section by section, I've asked the department to present the bill as amended by identifying the topic and the problem they are trying to solve, and then identifying how the sections in this bill address that problem. Several department staff will be presenting those sections of the bill to you today. I'm happy to present Cheryl Hennen, who will cover Article 1.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Cheryl Hennen, and I'm the State Ombudsman for Long-Term Care. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill. And I want to thank Representative Albright for his work to author the bill. I have worked with the Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care for 12 years. We represent the voice of consumers receiving long-term care services in the state of Minnesota. We walk side by side on a daily basis with consumers, which include older adults and people with disabilities, to resolve their concerns about rights violations and quality of care. Many of our clients are your constituents. We provide a regular presence in residential settings to work with consumers and staff to prevent problems and to resolve them in an informal manner. We also work to educate consumers and caregivers to become their own self-advocates. And we also are charged with working at a policy level to address systemic problems. Each state must ultimately determine the adequacy of its own statutes to ensure that the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program has the authority to carry out responsibilities according to the Older Americans Act. It is within the Older Americans Act where the mandate rests for the responsibilities of our office. The Administration for Community Living, Administration on Aging at the federal level, published the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program's final rule in February of 2015. This rule guides implementation of the Older Americans Act that governs federal grants to states for the operation of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program. The Minnesota Board on Aging is the designated state unit on aging for purposes of administrating the Older Americans Act. The Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program is a program of the Minnesota Board on Aging. Final rule compliance is required by July 1, 2016. Non-compliance places roughly 80% of our budget at risk. The proposed language clarifies the authority of the state ombudsman and the relationship between our employees or volunteers who carry out the duties of the office. So in closing, I will say to you, the work of the ombudsman is not accomplished in isolation. I value a collaborative relationship with stakeholders, and that includes long-term care provider organizations. I have met with and will continue to meet with our partners about the final rule and the proposed changes to our statute. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. And Representative Albright, do you have other testifiers?
Madam Chair and members, yes, I do. To cover Article 2, I have Carol Levine, and Article 3 will be Heidi Hamilton.
Okay, so Ms. Hennen, if you could just stay close by for questions, we'll do all the testifiers and then go to member questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Carol Levine, and I'm the Deputy Director for Adult Mental Health, which is part of the Mental Health Division at DHS. I will be speaking about to Article 2. First, I'll speak to Assertive Community Treatment. ACT is what we most commonly refer to. ACT is a community-based mental health service that is provided through a multidisciplinary team approach. It is a service designed for those with the most serious and persistent mental illness. It is for those individuals needing treatment at the highest level of intensity and frequency, and it is often referred to as a hospital without walls. It is a service that is supposed to be provided 24/7, 365 days a year. This proposal is meant to increase the quality of and the consistency of ACT services in Minnesota, and it does so by enhancing, strengthening, and clarifying the standards for ACT. In 2015, the legislature appropriated dollars to expand ACT into more parts of Minnesota. And as we expand, we want to ensure that there is consistent and high-quality services. This proposal is reflective of a collaborative process with our stakeholders. We started in August of 2015, where we had many stakeholder meetings over a few months. The stakeholders included consumers, family members, natural supports, ACT team providers, counties, and advocates. They've all come together to develop these standards that I will speak to today. The standards were also based off of research done with six different states, as well as following the National ACT standards. ACT is a specific model of care for individuals with psychotic-based illnesses, and so Minnesota has had ACT as a service since 2007, and during that time, we have found that we've drifted from the model. With the research mentioned previously, we've learned that more states have faced federal scrutiny because their state's ACT teams were too far from the model and did not look like the service the feds felt like they were paying for. So I'll now briefly walk through the proposal to talk about the changes that we are planning to fix this. So the first in the title, we wanted to provide clarifying, we were actually referring to ACT and keeping intensive residential treatment services within this section. Subdivision 1 is just a cross-reference cleanup. Subdivision 2 clarifies and adds more definitions that relate to ACT. Subdivision 2A makes it more clear who is eligible for the service and that it's also better aligned with the best practices. Subdivision 2B clarifies the continuing stay and discharge criteria for this service. Subdivision 3 has no substantial change. It's splitting out our intensive residential treatment from ACT. Subdivision 3A creates a distinct certification process. Currently, ACT is a part of another certification process, and ACT is just an add-on to that. So we want our own certification process for ACT. We also, Subdivision 4, as I said, ERTS isn't changing. Licensure isn't new, but this is a splitting ERTS intensive residential treatment away from ACT so that the language is distinct within the statute. Stricken language from pages 14 and 15 aren't going away, but are instead being moved. Subdivision 5A replaces old Subdivision 6 for the ERTS. Subdivision 7 is clarifying standards and lists out the actual expected array of services on an ACT team. And for definitions, you can go back to Subdivision 2, and that's where we've clarified those definitions. Subdivision 7B, we have a brand new section that clarifies the requirements of the treatment team staff, their qualifications, and their roles. Subdivision 7C is a new section, and this is addressing the need for flexibility in the size of teams so that the services can actually work in all of Minnesota, where, and we know it's specifically in greater Minnesota, where there's often more land than people. This section creates the standards for small, medium, and large ACT teams. To note, we've actually used these standards already, and we've found we have 5 upcoming teams in greater Minnesota. Subdivision 7D is new language, and it's about the expectations with the team on how they communicate and work with each other. Subdivision 7E is language from current law, and it's being moved into this section. Section E of this subdivision has added more focus on the client being the one that needs to drive their own treatment, and that it's expected to gather feedback from the person's identified family and natural supports. Subdivision 7F is giving us ACT variances. It's the ability to allow for some flexibility as we're so that we're able to meet issues as they arise while still protecting the quality of the teams. It will also allow us to be respectful of the need of current teams to transition to these new standards. What we did offer variances around would allow us to work with the growing workforce shortage issues as well as geographic issues as well. And then Subdivision 8 cleans up, for the sake of consistency, how we refer to people throughout the statute for the people who are receiving the services. In the last section, effective dates, the standards would be effective for any new teams starting July 1st of 2016, and current teams would have until January 1st of 2017 to come into compliance or come up with a plan as to how they would come into compliance. I'll also talk quickly about Section 2, and this is providing a technical cleanup for our what is commonly referred to as Youth Act, and it's creating clarification on the actual age range of youth that can receive the service. The age range isn't changing, it's just clarifying. And then Section 3 is around the authorization of substance use disorder treatment system reform, and this is directing DHS to develop a comprehensive package of reforms for Minnesota's substance use disorder treatment service system, which we plan to return in 2017 session with a proposal. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. And if you could just stay close by for questions, which we will get to after this final testifier. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services. I'll be reviewing Article 3, which is the miscellaneous article, so I will be talking about 6 distinct topics in each section. 6 sections within each, a topic each. So the first section is related to foster care variance. The current statute allows for a 5th bed to be added in emergency situations to a 4-bed home. This does not add to the permanent capacity of a setting, but it is used when there is an emergency crisis or a temporary need that needs to be addressed for an individual. When this statute was written, it was typical for homes to be 4 beds, but since the corporate foster care moratorium has been put in place, homes are typically developed around the needs of an individual and might be 1-bed home, 2-bed, 3-bed, or 4-bed home. And so the proposal is to allow for the ability to add an additional bed up to a 5-bed capacity to accommodate that need. Providers and lead agencies want the flexibility to have an additional bed for short-term needs regardless of what the permanent capacity of the setting is. Section 2 is related to the Child Fatality and Near Fatality Review Team. Legislation was passed in the 2015 session to implement recommendation from the Governor's Task Force on the Protection of Children, including the establishment of a DHS Child Fatality and Near Fatality Review Team. The 2015 legislation did not address the classification of the data information obtained by the review team. The proposed language aligns the classification of data acquired by this review process with the same level of classification for data acquired by local and state child mortality review panels. The proposed language also affords respect and privacy to families dealing with the loss or critical injury to a child. This means that information will not be disclosed about what occurs in the meeting except to carry out the purposes of the child fatality and near fatality review team. It's important to note that this proposal does not impact or diminish the federal Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act requirements for public disclosure, which can be found in Minnesota statute. Section 3 relates to group residential housing staff qualifications. This proposal changes the GRH staff requirements to allow staff members to transport residents of a GRH setting to hold a driver's license from any state rather than just a driver's license from Minnesota. This is particularly important in the border communities such as Moorhead and other areas where there may be a staff member living in another state. And this section also corrects a drafting error from the 2015 omnibus budget bill. Section 4 is related to the Performance Management Council. It modifies how the Human Services Performance Management System addresses disparities in county performance. The proposed language authorizes the Performance Management Council to develop a methodology that more accurately assesses the existing disparities and creates technical assistance and tools that specifically address the disparities. Counties are supportive of this change. Section 5 relates to the Olmsted Plan and implementation of that. People with disabilities may find it cumbersome to navigate our disability services system, which is administered across the Departments of Human Services, Education, Employment and Economic Development, and Health. This results in a barrier to services and a missed opportunity to improve the lives of people with disabilities and fulfill the obligations of the state's Olmsted Plan. The proposed language directs the commissioners of these various agencies, as well as information technology, to work together to develop a collaborative action plan to increase community integration of people with disabilities and to provide recommendations to the legislature by January 1st, 2017. And finally, Section 6 relates to medical assistance housing supports. Recent guidance from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services presented an opportunity that DHS wants to take advantage of, and we are looking for the direction and support from the legislature to begin preliminary work. This language requires DHS to design a housing support services and to return to the legislature in 2017 with a proposal.
Madam Chair, that
Representative Albright.
That completes the workup on the bill.
Okay. Thank you to the testifiers. Is there anyone else in the committee who wants to testify to the bill? Okay, if you could approach the table. We have a fairly long agenda today, so we're going to ask testifiers to keep their remarks to 2 minutes or less if weren't already previously listed on testifiers. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee of Health, is the reform?
Yes.
Reform. My name is Rick Heller. I officially represent the twice exceptional, which is Minnesota Statute 120B15, and print disabled found in the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008. Come to speak on 16419. It's, I believe, this is a bill that has not yet been read on the floor. It's a revisor's document. I think it's unreasonable that you have a document that isn't fully accessible. It's my understanding, unless it gets read on the floor, JAWS will not read struck through underlined language. It's my suggestion that you make it more accessible for the audience.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to clarify. What bill are you speaking? Are you testifying to right now?
Madam Chair, he's
Representative Albright.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Mr. Heller is speaking to the designation for the amendment in the upper right-hand corner, the 16-4619. But his remarks are specifically to the bill 3991.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Thank you. If I may continue, on page 39 of your document, specifically, last lady testified about the Olmsted Plan. I believe it starts on page line 24 and goes to page 40 to page 40 line point 4. I have specific query. I don't know if Department of Health, DEED, all the state agencies part of the OMSAT plan, I believe I've done a currently in a data request process to understand the functionality of the website, the OMSTAT group, because frankly, I would think that since the four state agencies involved, or is there five, frankly, that they're required to follow content accessibility law, statute 1603. It's my understanding that MINIT, Office Enterprise Technology formerly, are the ones that help them work toward compliance. However, in this situation, in the strategy plan, I don't see anything mentioned about statute 1603. And frankly, which again, I think that's a relevant piece, and I don't know if the individual wrote this bill would willing to yield to a change in that or make sure that gets in there, specifically spells that out. Because unless we spell it out, I can't find anyone who has governance, like the governor that appointed that committee, that regarding the content accessibility law. It kind of falls in the purview, I believe, of those agencies or the commissioners or both. So I think it's relevant to perhaps have that in discussion when getting the important piece of the OMSTAT plan regarding those that are perhaps blind or print disabled. Again, those are only two found in the Higher Education Opportunity Act. It has to do with a functional issue of people acquire, enjoy, and provide those same services with ease and use. If it's not functional, if it's not searchable, is it fair and equal for those individuals who are accessing the content online since we're going to 21st century? Thank you for this opportunity to speak. If you have any questions, I'm open to that.
Thank you for taking the time to be here. Members, questions for any of the testifiers? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just had a couple of questions for Ms. Hamilton in her section of the proposals, and I apologize that with the demands of the session, I hadn't had a chance to call her ahead of time, or talk to a few others. But I noticed that on page 37 on the imposing remedies when there's a performance issue with a county or service delivery authority on with disparities in the performance, which is something we want to take seriously. But the old language had actual a method of a criteria by which you would define it, whether statistically valid differences in outcomes. And now it's changed to just it's a performance disparity as recommended by the council and determined by the commissioner. And while there was testimony that they would be developing a methodology, there's absolutely no language that says that. So it feels really we're going from a measurable disparity to a council makes a recommendation to the commissioner, and it feels a little looser than perhaps you intended.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Hello, my name is Marissa Hinnenkamp. I am the Director of Agency and County Performance at the Department of Human Services. The performance management system is an area that I oversee, and I agree that we went from something that was very detailed and prescriptive to something that was a little bit looser. One of the issues and the main reason that we are doing so is because the original prescriptive language did not result in identifying disparities for any county. And as we know, disparities exist in Minnesota. So the existing language did not work in the way that was intended. We were not able to work with any counties to establish any performance improvement plans around disparities. We do have a work group that is meeting in 2 weeks with representatives from DHS, from our council, from the Cultural and Ethnic Communities Leadership Group, community members, and counties to help us develop a new methodology that is not yet in place, but we could bring information back.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have any problem with, you know, the previous measure being unworkable or you not having the data to really, you know, make it useful. But I am concerned that as the statute reads right now, there's no commitment to a methodology. It's just a council makes a recommendation. And so it would be really useful if you would think about some language we could add that would establish a process give the council responsibility for establishing some criteria so that people know what they're being held accountable to. And I have no hesitancy about holding anyone accountable, but I think of particularly for a rural county, which may only have, you know, a very limited number of people representing a particular interest, that they'd want to make sure that it's a fair system as well.
Yes.
And so if you could think about tightening that up, we don't have to go as tight as the old language, which was very prescriptive and statistical, but to have some kind of uniform measure that's reasonable based on the size of the county, I think would add strength to that part of the bill.
Thank you. Ms.
Hiddenkamp? Yes, Ms. Hiddenkamp.
Thank you. Yes, we will look at that.
Representative Loeffler.
And thank you, Madam Chair. The other question I had was on the action plan to increase community integration of people with disabilities. And this is, you know, the Olmstead decision, which is the constitutional right of people with disabilities to be served in the most integrated and an independent setting of their choice. The federal courts found us out of compliance, and you went through months and months of, you know, trying to meet the court's expectations in a plan to achieve that over time. And I'm just kind of surprised to see just a footnote on this policy bill, broad authority for the state agencies to totally put together an action plan without including all the affected state agencies or the stakeholders. And since housing is a huge issue to community integration, and these are people who are going to need affordable housing, we know their budgets, to not include, for example, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, which is, I keep hearing there's rumors of $100 to $130 million in bonding authority for more affordable housing. There's no priority given, as far as I know, to any of that being dedicated to helping us achieve our legal compliance with the Olmstead settlement. So is there a reason why the Housing Finance Agency isn't included, particularly since their head was actually the head of the Olmstead cabinet?
Ms. Hamilton.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I believe that may just have been an oversight and that we should include the Housing Finance Agency here.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and perhaps we can work on that as it goes ahead, but I do think we're not going to be able to get people living into the community if they don't have access to affordable housing. And we already find that that's a real bottleneck for people who are ready to, or always were able, to live more independently. The other question I have is that there's no provision in here for any consultation with parents, with family, with the counties, with the schools, with any of the stakeholders in the service provision. And so it feels really like a top-down, state agencies are going to go off and do the grand plan. And that's very unusual for a real major service redesign. And, you know, it has implications even just on the IT end for the investments that counties have made. I know my county has an integrated electronic case file that integrates some of these things. They kind of have to do it for their own management, even if the state hasn't done it ahead of time. And so I'm wondering, how do you envision this moving forward? And will it be like the Olmstead cabinet, where it's really mostly state agencies working together without really broad, continuous, at-the-table engagement of the people who are going to be most impacted?
Ms. Hamilton.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Alex Bartolik to respond to that question.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Alex Bartolik from the Department of Human Services. And Representative Loeffler, I think maybe we could look at the language. The intent was not to create a different plan. The intent was to look at how those state agencies, particularly those state agencies who work with individuals and are responsible for authorizing services and managing access to needed services, are able to share information, be able to provide people who use services with information. So it was to look at the foundation, fundamental, how the information system would flow. It was not to come up with a different plan. It was to look at how could we bring the Olmstead plan to life. And just as you commented, you know, Hennepin's been working at how to integrate a plan, and the state agencies don't have that capacity right now. So we'd be willing to look at language if it's not very clear.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think it's always just a temptation in drafting to make it broad authority. And so the language is to develop a collaborative action plan. An action plan is not a data sharing plan. To develop an action plan in alignment with the state's Olmsted plan to increase the community integration of people with disabilities, including housing, community living, and competitive employment. And to me, that can't happen without involving the local partners as well, because if you have a child with disabilities and they're interacting in the special ed system and they're interacting with the county human service system, it has to happen at that on the ground level as well as up at the higher level. And I'm just concerned about us having gaps in our system and it not being able to meet the needs of people who are actually dealing with individuals and implementing their individual life plan if it's designed really from a state agency perspective without them at the table. I would respectfully ask that we think about narrowing this to, but even on, if it's just data systems development, they're going to use those same systems, so they should be actually involved in that as well.
And Madam Chair,
Ms. Bartolik.
Representative Loeffler, I think this is a matter of wording. We have a very detailed plan, a work plan, of how we implement the Olmsted plan, and it includes work with school districts, with counties, it includes work on a local level and a lot of piloting of solutions and what we are trying to do. So the intent is very much there to include many people who are actually trying to use this that come back and say, what do we need to do as a state to make it happen? And so it's the business process. It's how do you manage your business as well as the systems to support it. But I get your message that the language doesn't relay the intent, and we can look at how to word it more clearly.
Representative Loeffler. Oh,
thank you, Madam Chair. And I do apologize that I wasn't able to look at the language before today's hearing. It's been a pretty intense session. So I would have reached out to you and others beforehand. But I do think, given the difficulties that we've had in the past in trying to integrate local and state plans, whether they're IT platforms or other things, I think studying the partnership from day one is a good route to go. Thank you.
Members, other questions? Okay, not seeing any. Representative Albright, final word on your bill?
Thank you, members, for your consideration and the robust conversation around the table.
Okay, so members, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 3199, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, the next bill on the agenda is House File 3170. Representative Pearson. And Representative Pearson moves that House File 3170 be re-referred to the General Register. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Pearson, to your bill.
Madam Chair, thank you. Members, this bill is the Department of Human Services Positive Supports Rule Bill. This is the bill's first hearing in the House. And this proposal provides legislative approval of Minnesota Rules Chapter 9544 governing positive support strategies and restrictive interventions. The rule is currently effective but only applied to all providers because of the governor's waivers that expires in August of 2016. Legislative approval will allow the rule to remain in full effect for all providers beyond this date. The 13 and 14 legislature authorized DHS to adopt rules that require providers to use person-centered principles and positive support strategies in the provisions of services. The rule also places limits on the use of restrictive interventions and detailed reporting and training requirements. The rule applies to all entities licensed under Minnesota statutes Section 245D, regardless of the disability status of the persons they serve. The rule also applies to all DHS licensees when serving a person with a developmental disability or related condition. If the legislature does not pass this bill in 2016, the rule will remain in place. However, once the governor's waiver expires in August of 2016, any small businesses with fewer than 50 employees may file a written statement claiming an exemption from the compliance with the rule, and the governor has the authority to issue a second waiver if the legislature does not approve this bill. DHS estimates that upwards to 90% of the 22,000 licensees who are subject to the rule could qualify as a small business and could claim an exemption. Today I have a staff member with DHS to give testimony, and she could answer any questions that the members might have.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself. I don't know if you want to testify to the bill or just here for questions, whatever you're most comfortable with.
Sure, Madam Chair and members. My name is Alex Bartolik. I am from the Department of Human Services. And maybe just add a few more comments to this. The promulgation of the positive supports rule was required as part of our Jensen settlement. And it's an integral part of our Olmstead plan, which we were just talking about. The Olmstead plan is a blueprint of how we're going to improve our system across the state in order to support people with disabilities to live and work and enjoy life in their communities. And part of that is being treated respectfully and having guidelines around best practices to support people to learn new skills and to prevent them from being subjected to more restrictive interventions. So the day after enactment, this proposal would provide legislative approval for this rule to be applied across the state. And as Representative Pearson said, in 2015, we completed the rulemaking process. It became effective on August 31st of 2015, and it does affect how DHS licensed programs serve people. And in this, we had estimated that the cost of complying with the rule after it took effect would not exceed $25,000. While the administrative law judge did approve the rule, they disagreed with the strategy that we had laid forth. And so they said that it would allow a small business to do the exemption. And as was stated, it would be about 90% of the 22,000 license holders would qualify for this exemption. Minnesota law outlines a number of exemptions. One of them is that the governor can grant a waiver to require people to comply, and we're asking for the legislature to take action. The ability of DHS to apply this rule uniformly is crucial to assuring that people with disabilities receive services that adhere to best practice standards across the state. And the foundation for this rule was established when the legislature authorized new licensing standards under 245D. That contains many of the provisions that are already in the rule. Medicaid also requires that we apply positive standards, and we have assurances in our home and community-based waiver programs that state that we will be following the statute and the positive support rule. If the legislature doesn't approve the rule and the governor doesn't sign a waiver, as was said, 90% of intended businesses are eligible to be exempt. This means that people with disabilities will face a greater risk of receiving services that are not in adherence with best practice standards. We won't be in compliance with our federal assurances, and because this is necessary to fulfill our commitment in the Olmstead Plan and the Jensen Settlement, failure to apply it uniformly may result in court actions. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, and Representative Pearson, do you have any other testifiers?
I do not.
Okay, is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify to the bill? Okay, members, not seeing any other testifiers. Members, questions? Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, I just have to say that after seeing the news reports of some injuries out of our state security hospital, out of the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, I have real concerns about the limitations in some very specific instances on the use of restraints for employee safety. And so I'm wondering if the testifier has some information that she can provide. At what point when you're walking a patient through a corridor at the security hospital, is it okay to get them under control? We've had a huge spike in workplace injuries. I think it was up 50% year-to-date last summer with first reports of injury. And that's just so everyone understands the types of injuries. The classification is that if upon the injury and going to seek medical treatment, it requires more than just basic first aid. We've had state employees suffer traumatic brain injuries. We've had state employees have severe sprains and fractures. I just have real concern about the idea that in some very, very specific descriptive areas, this causes a huge workplace safety issue. And then at the legislature, we got to sit back and wonder why there's a shortage of employees and why different facilities are having a hard time getting fully staffed. And this is a huge part of that, because at some instances, they're forced to work in a very unsafe environment. And these rules promulgate that. And so I'm just wondering if the testifier has some thoughts on what some of our employees should do when they're in that type of situation. Since we are outlawing any use of mechanical restraints, and we're putting folks in a very, very difficult position. And whether you have someone escorted by one employee or by two employees, if that person decides to become violent, what is their alternative?
Ms. Bertolic.
Madam Chair and committee members, you know, you're raising a really important point about it is important for safety. It's important for people being served and also for people delivering services. A couple of points is this rule does not apply to Anoka Regional Treatment Center. That's a hospital. It's not a DHS-licensed facility. It does apply to part of the security hospital when they're serving a person with a developmental disability. And the security hospital has a number of different regulations that come upon that. So this is not being applied across all of these programs in the same way. I can't address all of your specific points, but I do know that the more we try to restrain people, that's usually when we run into more issues of staff getting hurt as well. But there are protocols with the security hospital and at Anoka that these particular provisions do not necessarily restrict people from applying them in those conditions, because it's very limited in those state-operated, those particular facilities.
Representative Zerwas.
Well, and I appreciate the clarification that this only applies as far as a hospital, so AMRTC is having a different set of challenges. I talked to a group of employees from the state security hospital who talks about the training that's required, the 8 hours of training and the 4 hours of refresher. It just so members are aware, when I talked to a group of employees last year and they told me about their 4 hour refresher training, one of the trainings that they went to talked about what to do when someone begins throwing things at them. And the training wisely suggested ducking. That is the level of training we're providing our employees, while then saying it's against the rules, it's against the laws to restrain someone. This is a very difficult situation. It's a very difficult environment to work with. I understand that you're trying to implement the rulings. I think that this is way too far. I talked to a group of folks that are providing home and community-based support services in the community, and one of their concerns with the protective measures here is that one of the restraints prohibited is restraints for folks when they take them out in the community. There's a type of restraint that you can put on someone in a vehicle so they can't undo their safety belt if they might be prone to. And in some instances, I talked to care providers where they were caring for folks that may open a car door when the vehicle's on the freeway and try to exit the vehicle when the car's traveling down the freeway. So they make a type of restraint that when the person is in the vehicle, they can be secured in that vehicle. Well, that is against the rules as put forth by DHS. And so we have one part of the system that says, get folks out to the community, get them integrated, get them out. And then we have another rule that says, you cannot make it safe for them to be in a vehicle for folks that might be prone to opening a car door and exiting the vehicle during during travel, during motion. So I had providers saying, well, which one am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to take my residents and my clients to the park, to the zoo, and get them as ingratiated and involved in the community as possible? Or, because I've seen them try to jump out of moving vehicles in the past, and now it's going to be against the rules to secure them in the vehicle, do I never take them out again? Because in good conscience, I don't believe I can take that risk. In these new set of rules, do we have that addressed? So those folks, we can at least get them out of the group home setting and into the community.
Ms. Bertolli.
Yep. Madam Chair, the statute that already has passed actually prohibits many of those things. The rule, while it clarifies that more, and it's true that some of the restraints, because they also could prevent a person from getting out of a car in case of emergency and other things, does have provisions where they can be used, where the provider can get assistance in planning, how could we teach people, how could we do something different. So it acknowledges that there might be situations where that occurs, and it sets up a process to be able to provide technical assistance to the provider, and then we document it. So we do know how many times providers are using these seatbelt clips in order to do it, and also what are we doing to help either figure out different ways of helping that person be safe or else help the provider understand how we can manage that going forward. So we want people to be able to be out. It's not saying that they never ever could do it. It is saying that we want to be able to work through a program to teach the person and figure out some different ways to support them going out so they might not be as reliant on having the seatbelt clips.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, members, what I appreciate that I think reliant on the seatbelt clips. If you have someone that's a danger, you're going to want to keep them belted in. So I don't know that it's a question of whether they're not they're reliant on them. You would be reliant on the seatbelt clips for safety of the driver, for safety of the passenger, for safety of the person that you are there to protect and provide a supportive environment for. And so members, I understand this is moving forward today, but I have some real concerns about some of these rules and how this looks moving forward. I think we have seen over the last 18 months an unbelievably dangerous situation at the security hospital that's only gotten more and more alarming. And these types of rules, I was at a group in St. Cloud of care providers that when they called DHS asking for assistance on just that seat clip rule, they were told that that's a restraint that is not allowed. I had two dozen providers talk to me about that in St. Cloud just this fall. So it is certainly an issue, and I think some of the rules are doing the exact opposite of what they're set up to do. That's all I have to say, Madam Chair.
Members, other questions? Not seeing any. Representative Pearson, final word on your bill.
I guess I would just, again, continue to say this is part of getting focused on the person-centered care and those principles of positive support strategies, and appreciate the time, and thank you to the testifier. And I'll look forward to moving this bill forward.
Okay, members, Representative Pearson renews his motion that House File 3170 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Pearson. Okay, Representative Pearson, you have the next bill up, House File 3429. Representative Pearson moves that House File 3429 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. We have the bill in front of us, and Representative Pearson, I believe you have an A1 amendment.
I do have an A1 amendment, just a substitution of word.
Okay, so members, Representative Pearson moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order that he would like it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Pearson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. Today, we're coming before you basically with a need that's been brought up in several occasions in various committees that I serve on, and I'm sure you've heard about the needs of dental care. Specifically for those disparity in incomes is creating a disparity of access to dental care that is really catastrophic within our state. Representative Zerwas, I know, has authored many bills to address this very topic, and this is actually developing a very specific pilot project. I have testimony or testifiers here that will basically give an outline of the project and enlighten you on its merits.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you very kindly for giving me this opportunity, and Representative Pearson, thank you very kindly, sir. My name is Vachery Peterson. I'm a dentist and CEO for Community Dental Care, a nonprofit organization. 2 weeks ago, one of our doctors had extracted two severe infected teeth of a child of 18 months old. And last week, I read the CNN news report of a 14-month-old baby girl died last Tuesday after a dental filling procedure under general anesthesia in Austin, Texas. This should never have happened if the parents had had the opportunity to learn how to take care of their child's teeth as soon as teeth erupt. Please take a look at the handout number one. It is good to take a child to have his teeth cleaned twice a year at the dental office, or visit his medical doctor and receive preventive fluoride varnish 6 times per year. However, when the child goes home, he still needs his parents to clean his teeth 365 days a year. Teeth are like dishes. They are dirty after each use or being bathed in the milk. The child's dental home should also be at home, where the parents are responsible for his or her teeth every day. Please see handout number two. It has a message from the child to the parents. I've got teeth. I want to keep them. Dad and Mom, would you please brush them twice a day and 365 days a year? And we would like to also ask these parents that we train to be our missionaries to go and tell their neighbor and bring more people to come in to learn. This pilot project will not only start training the targeted communities, but it will bring awareness also. The communities will help spread the news about the importance of brushing twice a day, 365 days a year, and spread it as quickly as possible. It has the measurement component in it to track the success. Would you please support this bill? Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. And we'll take all the testifiers, so if you could stay nearby for questions, if members have any, that would be great. Welcome to the next testifier. If you could just introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I know that on the schedule you have Anjali Mishra, our research analyst, who is scheduled to testify, but I'm here because at the last moment she wasn't able to join you. So thank you so much for the opportunity to come before all of you. As most of you may already know, I am the executive director at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. The council was created to advise you and the governor's office to the extent possible as you go about making decisions on behalf of Minnesotans, including the Asian Pacific Minnesotan community. So I'm here to share with you why, although this bill is addressing a much broader group of Minnesotans, why the Asian Council is, why the Council believes that passage of House File 3249 is really in the best interest of Minnesota, particularly as the state strives to address health disparities. The Council, again, represents a community of over 260,000 Minnesotans descended from more than 40 nations. These Minnesotans make up slightly more than 4% of Minnesota's total population. We are the fastest growing ethnic group here in the state as well as across the nation. While 84% of our community reside in the 7-county metro area, we also have growing communities in greater Minnesota, for example, in Warroad, Baudette, Marshall, Austin, Albert Lea, and Worthington. And unlike any other state in the nation, Minnesota's Asian American community is majority Southeast Asian, and that's particularly relevant to a conversation about the kind of pilot project that we're talking about today. When the Council isn't at the Capitol, we are particularly and strategically inside our communities. Interactions with community members and particularly with medical professionals tell us that our community will directly benefit from such a program that's designed to increase early preventive dental intervention for infants and toddlers. Now, according to the American Community of Pediatric Dentistry, tooth decay can have detrimental impacts on young children due to increased risk of oral pain or infection, nutritional problems, and even sleep deprivation or poor concentration. Experts agree that utilization of oral health care can reduce tooth decay in young children and can lead to improved quality of life and the reduction of later financial and societal costs. For many in the Asian Pacific Minnesotan community, particularly for our refugee community members, the U.S. healthcare system can be frightening. At best, it is a mystery. Added to this, barriers such as 1, limited English proficiency, 2, high illiteracy rates in their own native languages, and 3, traditional understandings of the body and medicine. And many of Minnesota's Asian Pacific members do not recognize the value or necessity of obtaining care. So, for example, in one of our largest and newest refugee communities, the Karen, members of this particular community believe that pain anywhere on and in the body is an imbalance between natural forces around them. You can see that that kind of belief requires strategic intervention on the part of mainstream Minnesota. And so when we interrupt these traditional or what some of us may consider poor oral health behaviors, we empower parents and we help to prevent later stage disease diagnosis. I would just add that according to the Center for Disease Control for Asian American Children, underutilization of dental care service was most prevalent among those whose parents have had less than 12 years of education, who do not have health insurance coverage, and or who were at or below the poverty line at that point in time. Southeast Asian mothers also tend to have more children per household, meaning that the positive effects of an early intervention within our young community could really be exponentially greater than what we are even anticipating. So I'll conclude by saying that as the Asian Pacific Minnesotan community, as well as other cultural communities, continue to grow here in the state of Minnesota, it is incredibly important that we provide ongoing and targeted health-focused education for these families. Providing preventive oral health education for families will have an important impact on the overall health of Minnesota's youngest and most often most vulnerable populations. Thank you so much for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that members of the committee may have.
Thank you for taking the time to be here. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify to the bill? Not seeing any members. Questions? Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you. And I just want to comment, really, Dr. Peterson does terrific work in this area. And Dr. Peterson, I still have on my office wall that color photograph that you distributed before showing children's teeth that are rotted. And if anybody on the committee hasn't seen it, I know, and I'm sure you've seen it, you know what I mean. It's really horrible to think that any child should go through that, especially when it's preventable. So, and of course, it is preventable, as she was saying, and I think this is a terrific effort, and we should absolutely do this if we can. But let me just ask either of the testifiers, you know, it's so sort of shocking to all of us that we don't already do this, because it seems like such a no-brainer that parents should be getting this kind of education, you know, from their, you know, prenatally or right after the child is born or in some setting. And so I guess I'd just like to ask, you know, what's our problem that we don't have this already going on in the state?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
May I speak now?
Yes, okay. Yes.
Representative Living, thank you, ma'am, for the question. A lot of underserved children, usually from a lot of them are recent immigrants, or they have dysfunctional families. Or if we talk about, when we talk about the children of color, please note that white also are color. And so when we serve the underserved, we just call the underserved. And we just serve anybody who come in. They need education. And we have also noticed children who we have really good training for the parents, and the parents are excited, they go home. But lo and behold, the parents actually maybe, please allow me to use the word, working poor. And so the grandparents may be babysitting the children, and they were the one who were dentures and did not know how to take care of the children's teeth, so they would just give them Coke. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say Coke, but pop, soda pop. And so this has very low acid, like pH of 2.7, and the battery is 1 point something. So these soda pop basically soak the teeth and create little microscopic holes each day, and when they call it to be really big, the natural body, the saliva, cannot repair them fast enough, so that become cavity and become really fast. And then when we also study is that they would just, the aunt and uncle and the grandparents also give them all of these sweet food that would cause caries. And this is the education we need to give to our underserved population, ma'am. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Peterson. I think this is, you know, absolutely great idea, and I really hope that we can get it funded. And, you know, I see it's a pilot, and of course, you know, we would see how effective it is, and then hopefully, you know, I think we should have the goal that no child in Minnesota should have cavities in their teeth. I think we can do that, and we should do that, and I think that if we did that, that the money that we would spend making sure that happened would save us a lot of money down the road and would make a lot of children's lives happier and healthier. So thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Dr. Peterson.
Yeah. In response to Representative Liebling, this project would help us create a project named Minnesota Cavity Free Kids. So thank you. It's very appropriate.
Other questions, members? Not seeing any. Representative Pearson, final word on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In my final comments, I guess I might address what Representative Liebling was pointing out as well. Is one of the things I've kind of learned is how our medical profession has kind of looked at our mouths as being actually outside of the body. And so we really have had this dilemma, I think, of you know, we have pediatricians and folks that have been out in the medical profession for decades, generations, frankly, and the way our medical industry has viewed it is not our department, and that we need to have you know, the world of dentistry take that on. I think the education component is something that the dentists haven't had access to do that education, that our pediatricians are able to reach out and talk to parents and have that access. But the world of dentistry just hasn't had that opportunity, and we're hoping that this is one step to hopefully make that happen and raise awareness and educate.
Okay, members, with that, thank you, Representative Pearson. Representative Pearson renews his motion that House File 3429, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Pearson. Members, our next bill will be Representative Peterson's bill, House File 3486. And Representative Peterson moves that House File 3486 be re-referred to the General Register. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Peterson, I believe you have a DE amendment.
That is correct, Madam Chair. But it's an A2 delete all amendment.
Is this my chair?
Okay, so members, and Representative Peterson, I have the DE1 amendment. In our packet?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay, so members, Representative Peterson moves the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the order that she would like. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Peterson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And basically with that delete all amendment, we remove sections 2, 3, and 4 from the bill. So we're just focusing on section 1, which was the work that was done very collaboratively with all the advocates and DHS in response to the disability home and community-based services waiver. So as you may recall, there was a controversy over unspent but available funding with thousands of eligible people that were on waiting lists. And so this is basically a reaction to that report. And part of it has to do with doing some better communication and increasing the transparency. So this bill will allow monthly reports to be provided to interested parties about their areas, counties, available funds, and improve that accountability, as we discussed before. And it's so that the money that is intended for these people with disabilities actually get it. It also requires a quarterly information about waiting lists, and it's consistent with basically the Olmstead Act. All this information will be compiled into an annual report to be posted on the DHS website, which will also include DHS actions to assure funds are being used and directed where needed in the state. So because the data for these reports is the data DHS already uses to manage HCBS waiver funding, and the reports are consistent with the department's Olmstead reporting, there is no cost for this bill. So with that, Madam Chair, I do have Ann Henry, who is with the Minnesota Disabilities Law Center, to discuss the bill further.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good afternoon. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Disability Law Center at Legal Aid. Very briefly, some background. The public, there used to be a requirement that most of this information was compiled in an annual public report. In 2014, that changed, and the department instead said they would provide that information upon request. But, of course, that isn't really a very transparent way to reveal how you manage a system and how the waiting lists are going. So we worked with the department on figuring out what information they already use and what reports they have to do, because we really think that with all the controversy about wait lists and unspent money, it behooves us all that a broader group of people understand how the program's managed. It is somewhat complicated. And so the department is willing to do that and to post this online, fiscal information monthly, at the local level, also see how their local agencies, the counties, are doing. So we definitely ask for your support. We think it'll translate into better accountability at both the state and the local level for this very important funding for home and community waiver services. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for being here. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify to the bill? Not seeing any members' questions. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And, I think this is a fine idea, but as I'm looking at the bill, I wonder sometimes you know, I think this is all important information to have, and one hopes that it will help people kind of understand what's going on and maybe alleviate some anxiety or some sense that, you know, they're just staring into a black box or something like that. But in this report that is going to be compiled, I wonder if it would make sense to put in something here about how many hits that website gets. Because sometimes I wonder, you know, we like to think we're doing all this great stuff and we post all this information, and I just wonder how many people actually avail themselves of it. And, I mean, even if one or two avail themselves of it, it probably would still be worth doing, even if, you know, we around this table might want to take a look at it once in a while. But I just wonder how hard it would be for the department to just add that. I think that computer systems probably, you know, they record that, I think.
Ms. Henry. Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, well, I actually am not an expert that could tell you that, but I think that data is probably available, and it would really be a question for the department, and it may be something for you to ask them next session after they begin this report in August. I can tell you that in our office, when we have people who really need services and they come to us, we do seek this information to know whether the county has room to add them or whether, you know, we can talk to the state and say, look, this county is really under-resourced, and have you considered moving money from a place that's not being used? So we certainly use it in advocating for people, and I think that's probably true of other advocacy organizations.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, thank you for that, because that does kind of put a different spin on it, for lack of a better word, that, you know, maybe the individuals won't be so much checking it, but certainly the people who assist them will be. So, thank you.
Okay. Members, other questions? Excuse me, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed that the Delete Everything Amendment added on a repealer, and could you tell us, Representative Peterson, what's being repealed?
Representative Peterson.
Section 2 repeals a requirement from last session, the two reports which aren't needed because the required information is included in the broader, more comprehensive reporting responsibility. The information will be posted sooner and more frequently under the new requirements under this bill.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. We never remember by number what we've passed.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Okay, members, not seeing any other questions. Representative Peterson renews her motion that House File 3486, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Peterson. Next bill, just a moment, members. Representative Baker. We will do House File 2661. Representative Baker moves that House File 2661 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And Representative Baker, I understand we have a DE1 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a DE1 amendment. I'd like to introduce that if I could to make the bill how we would like to see it.
Right.
Okay, Representative Baker moves the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the order that he would like. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Baker, to your bill as amended.
Madam Chair, thank you, members. Today is a important bill for me because this is about a pilot project about helping kids and adolescents transitioning into youth programs, into adult programs, when it comes to some collaborations with folks that need special services. You know, with me today is Deb Sheehan. She's the executive director with PAC for Families, and she's got a great story to tell. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Deb Sheehan. I'm director of PAC for Families, which is the Children's Mental Health and Family Services Collaborative. Just to start a little bit with what is the issue, one out of five youth have a mental health disorder. One out of four adults does. That's 20 to 25% of the population struggling with mental health needs. Adolescence is a time when symptoms of major mental health concerns emerge, particularly between ages 15 and 25. First episode psychosis, major anxiety problems, chemical health issues, depression, and suicide. All are issues that tend to emerge at this early time. Untreated youth have high rates of suicide. They have medical problems, homelessness, unemployment, incarceration, truancy, difficulty concentrating in school or focusing attention on tasks at home, at part-time work or during extracurricular activities. They tend to have poor peer and parental relations. But receiving treatment isn't easy. Access to services is limited, especially in rural areas. Negotiating the numerous hurdles of how to arrange for treatment, how to set goals for one's future, how to find housing, how to apply for a job and keep it, while dealing with major mental health concerns is a daunting task. Let me give you just two examples. Jack is really struggling at school. He is listless or preoccupied, truant or sleeping through classes. He's bullied by his peers and aggressive in return. His hygiene isn't the best and he often talks to himself. He's been in trouble with the police for petty crimes, but is in with a group of boys who is daring him to take his parents' handgun and hold up a local convenience store. A social worker at school refers him for help, and he finally agrees to ask his parents if he can participate in a pilot project to work with youth like him. The first step, no matter what severity or type of mental illness, is to seek support from a mental health professional, whether that's in the capacity of a licensed counselor, psychologist, or medical mental health professional. Taking this initiative is key. Once the mental health plan is in place, this project would work to assist Jack to identify his future goals and how he can make them within reach in addition to becoming psychologically healthy. Simple things like learning basic finance and taking regular showers to harder issues like how to say no when someone approaches him about buying some pot and about how to put his educational plan into motion, and decision making and safe sex are some of the skills he would likely be working on. Jessie, on the other hand, has been using drugs and alcohol to self-medicate since she tried to kill herself last month. She's in such a dark place that she can hardly leave her house when all of a sudden her single mom hears she is pregnant and kicks her out of the house. Jessie is 16. She's pregnant and homeless, but also hopeless and sees no point in going on. She's been in the local crisis program before and refuses to go back. She hears about this program and refers herself. So what is this pilot or demonstration project? This bill looks at supporting a project that can demonstrate the power of intervening early, as has been demonstrated in federally funded SAMHSA projects from 2002 through 2007. Through this bill, we hope to demonstrate that a coaching approach is both powerful and cost-effective in rural Minnesota. Is it really possible to help those vulnerable youth to a healthy adulthood while saving costs to society? Social return on investment rigorously determines costs of programs and the related financial benefit. In general, what are the costs of early intervention and comparing the costs of waiting? Well, residential treatment for a year costs the state or local government $75,300. Group homes, $56,100. Juvenile correctional facilities, $40,200. Juvenile court cases, $3,500 per case. This demonstration project is projected at about $13,750 per client per year. So the idea is that collaboratives in rural Minnesota, children's mental health collaboratives having been designated by the Minnesota legislature beginning in 1993, would work with partners in their area to bring this demonstration project forward, to have it vigorously tested, and then to come back and report on a regular basis to the legislature on both meeting the needs and the goals of the project and what the cost effectiveness is. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other people in the audience who want to testify to the bill? Not seeing any members' questions. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Representative Baker, and to your witness, I believe in prevention and trying to approach this and appreciate you bringing this forward. I'm wondering, though, why Representative Baker, typically when we pilot things, we try and test them out in a couple of different environments. Obviously, delivering services within a metro area is different than in a rural area, and I'm wondering why you didn't include a pilot in another area of the state rather than just a rural pilot.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I think it's a good question. For us, when this came to my attention from Ms. Sheehan, it was a very successful program back in the 2002-2007 area. This was initially kind of started from a collaborative with PAC-4. It's a cluster of counties out in west central Minnesota. For me, it was about feeling that there wasn't as much mentoring and coaching in rural Minnesota than there would be in other areas. So this is a competitive grant program. It could go to really anywhere. It's designed for rural Minnesota. I just felt that, again, the need that I see out there is great, and the program that they've ran before deserved another run at this. So I felt that it was a good balance, and that's why I wrote the bill like I did.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I think when it gets to finance, we should look at testing models. I think sometimes we put together models that work in one part of the state and then we try and implement in other areas. I know, you know, a metro rate would probably not work in your area model, but we need to kind of figure out what are the key elements that really work for kids no matter where they are. No matter where they are, they're confronting the issues that you just listed and need people that they can turn to and in times of need. And so I hope we'll be open to looking at that.
Yes. Other questions, members? Not seeing any. Representative Baker, final word on your bill.
Again, thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I love the mentoring, the coaching side of this thing. It was very successful when it was enacted before, and I would highly encourage us to support the bill. So thank you very much, members.
Okay, members, Representative Baker renews his motion that House File 2661, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed,
aye.
No. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Baker.
Thank you.
Members, next we will take up Representative Murphy's bill, House File 3228. And members, I will move that House File 3228 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And we have the bill in front of us. I don't think I see any amendments, Representative Murphy. There is an amendment,
yes,
members.
Madam Chair and members,
excuse me,
an amendment.
Excuse me, Representative Murphy spoke out of turn.
We should have read.
How are the cookies, by the way?
Okay. Oh, members, we have the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order that the author would like. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Murphy, to your bill as amended.
Thank you very, very much, Madam Chair, for hearing House File 3228, which is a proposal to evaluate the 2016 open enrollment operations and performance of MNsure. The amendment that you just adopted shifts the responsibility to letting a contract to a vendor from MNIT to MMB. This proposal is the result of the work of the Governor's Healthcare Financing Task Force that occurred last year. Representative Mack and Representative Schultz, I believe, were both on that task force. There were a number of proposals that came out of the work of that group, and one is this proposal, which was supported in bipartisan fashion and unanimously by the working group, that suggested that it is time for us to evaluate the performance of MNsure. So this legislation proposes evaluation of four areas of performance. The first is the enrollment of trends in qualified health plans offered through MNsure, the percentage of enrollees accessing the tax credits, the effectiveness of consumer outreach and education, and the adequacy of the financing of MNsure. The second is the assessment of the consumer experiencing and enrolling in MNsure. The third asks for a report on MNsure's progress in meeting the MNsure information technology development and modernization benchmarks. And the fourth, is the extent MNsure subsidies and efforts reduce churn in the market, promotes continuous coverage that leads to better health outcomes. Obviously, the task force is looking for both technical and more value-based criteria in the evaluation. And I know that we have had this legislature and previous legislatures have had serious disagreement over the existence of MNsure, and we've had a lot of difficulty in Minnesota with the first open enrollment and recently with the 1095s. So I think it is important for us as a legislature to take a look ahead, to ask an outside vendor to take a look at its performance, and to bring back in 2017 a report that allows us to evaluate based on the criteria that we set the ongoing performance of MNsure. I remember the first bill that I had heard in this legislature in 2007 was a bill to expand Minnesota Care for small business for small businesses and their employees. And Representative Laura Broad at the time asked me countless questions about that idea. And it taught me then that we do have significant differences in our approach to the coverage of people's health. Some prefer the private market, others prefer a public option or the public programs that we have in place. But I think we agree that wherever people are getting their health coverage, we want it to be reliable and affordable. And this piece of legislation would allow us together to do an evaluation of MNsure. I think it's important that we hold them, DHS, and MNIT accountable, and we will get good information from this. And with that, I ask for your support.
Okay, before we go to questions, is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify to the bill? Not seeing any. Members, are there questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Murphy, we've had the OLA expand and expound on the MNsure program, and I think the veracity and the credibility of that report is without question. So my first question goes to, in light of that, when we already know that MNsure is flawed and dysfunctional, why would we want to expend additional tax dollars on an outside firm to substantially verify that which the OLA has already confirmed to us?
Madam Chair,
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Albright. I think it's important to recognize that the OLA's work is retrospective, and we're asking in this piece of legislation to evaluate the performance of MNsure in 2016. So this would be new information for us to consider in 2017. From my perspective, MNsure is making significant progress, and while they still are having issues, as are DHS with some of their enrollment processes and MNIT, I think it's important for us to continue to evaluate the work that they're doing, because while we disagree on maybe the existence of MNsure, and some in this legislature would like to see a different approach, while Minnesotans are getting their coverage and the tax credits through MNsure, I think it's important for us to understand its continued progress, to measure that, and then to legislate based on that information.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Murphy, the MNsure Legislative Oversight Committee has responsibility to that task as well. So to that extent, what input from that organization will be made in terms of the selection of the organization to actually provide that report back to the legislature?
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, the administration, if this legislation is passed, it will be the administration and the Department of Management and Budget that will let that contract. I'm not sure that they would ask the LOC, although I am sure if we had an opinion about that, either this legislature or the Legislative Oversight Committee, we could offer that to them. I don't have a lot of expertise in the outside vendors at this point, so I would need to get a little bit smarter about that myself.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Murphy, as a follow-on to that, then, with the evaluation coming, that's a two-part question. First part is, with the evaluation, will it include recommendations for improvement and any specificity on that? But then also, as a kind of an op-ed, and I'm hoping you'd be able to expand on this, is given the fact that open enrollment is going to be closed just a month before this report is due to the legislature, I'm just wondering the contemporary nature of the evaluation coming on the heels of the open enrollment process, how would we be able to implement changes recommended in that report prior to 2018 then?
Representative Murphy. Madam Chair and Representative Albright, to your last question, this legislation asks that there be a report produced by January 15th of 2017, giving us time in 2017 to be able to review and act upon that report in order to make changes if necessary for the 2018 open enrollment period.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members, other questions? Not seeing any. Representative Murphy, the only comment that I just briefly had was I don't see anything at first glance, but obviously in the midst of all of the Minsure issues, and we talk about QHPs a lot, but I know that one conversation that tends to sometimes get lost is the impact on counties, and even hearing earlier this morning from people representing the counties, just the incredible morale hit that the counties are taking among staff with the ongoing frustrations. And we can talk about it offline, but that the bill makes sure to address the county needs also. So, Representative Murphy, final word, and then we'll go to a vote.
Madam Chair, I think between now and when this is heard in Health and Human Services Finance, we could talk about the counties and see if there's something we could do about that. And with that, again, thank you very much for hearing the bill, and I'd ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Members, I will renew my motion that House File 3228, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Murphy. Members, the next bill that we will take up is Representative Zerwas's bill, House File 2703. And Representative Zerwas moves that House File 2703 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. That is my motion. House File 2703 allows federally qualified health centers to determine presumptive eligibility for medical assistance for pregnant women and children under 1 year of age. Minnesota's FQH estimates serving approximately 600 uninsured children under 1 year old and approximately 900 uninsured pregnant patients who are eligible for medical assistance but are not currently covered. As of 2014, 34 states allow PE determinations for pregnant women or children. 19 of those states may deem federally qualified health centers as qualified entities to make determinations. Minnesota is not currently one of these states, and this bill will change that. Presumptive eligibility does not allow patients to bypass the enrollment process, and patients will still need to enroll for MA. FQHCs and communities provide services necessary and within their abilities for these patients, regardless of their insurance status. However, having the ability to determine presumptive eligibility allows these providers to access additional necessary service for patients, such as specific prescription drugs coverage that they might need. Providers will reinvest these scarce resources back in to services from the reimbursement of that care, which currently is being done as uncompensated care. And with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to our testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Zoas. And just, I'll just interject briefly. I didn't say this, members, but we do have the room reserved past 4:30, so we'll finish our agenda. We have this and one final bill just to give members a roadmap of where we're going. So welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and fellow members. My name is Sonia Batalden, and I'm the lead nurse midwife at Westside Community Health Services here in St. Paul. And I'm honored to be trusted with the care of some of our community's more vulnerable women and their growing families. As a nurse midwife in a federally qualified health center, one of my principal goals is to remove barriers to care and to pave the way for women towards healthy living. The state of Minnesota has already recognized the value of prenatal care to improve health outcomes. Early access to prenatal care improves birth weights, reduces preterm birth, decreases perinatal mortality, and significantly cuts the cost of care in the first year of life. In order to further improve access to prenatal services, it's time for Minnesota to join 34 other states in offering presumptive eligibility for pregnant women and their newborn children. FQHCs are perfectly positioned and equipped to provide these services. I'd like to share just a few quick snapshots that bring this bill to life and demonstrate some of the barriers that exist for pregnant women in Minnesota. Janet presented to our clinic for prenatal care early in her pregnancy. As part of routine labs, a urine test showed some bacteria. She needed a relatively cheap course of antibiotics for bladder infection. Although she had applied for insurance, she had not yet received her benefits. She was unable to pay the money at the pharmacy for the antibiotics. Embarrassed that she could not afford the medication, she did not return to the clinic for a few weeks. When she returned, her infection had spread to her kidneys. She landed in the hospital with a prolonged intensive care hospitalization for very serious complications of this kidney infection. Luckily, both Janet and her baby survived this ordeal, but this costly journey, both in financial and health terms, could have been avoided for Janet and our healthcare system. If we had been able to remove the barriers to insurance for Janet, we could have paved the way for her to get this course of antibiotics. And HB 2703, our health center, can do that. When Mai came to our clinic, she had previously given birth to a preterm baby. For women with a history of preterm birth, giving weekly progesterone injections from about 16 or 18 weeks can decrease their risk of having another preterm baby. We helped Mai apply for insurance right away, but we needed the insurance information to be able to place the order for the specialized weekly injections. We continued to see her on a regular basis without the coverage, but we were not able to begin the weekly injections until about 26 weeks of pregnancy when we had her insurance information in hand. This was 2 months later than the recommended time to start treatment. Mai carried this baby longer than her first, but still gave birth preterm. Earlier access to these injections may have allowed Mai to carry the baby to term. Preterm births are costly to families and society, creating expensive extended neonatal intensive care stays, increased needs for early childhood education, and special education services. With HB 2703, we could remove this barrier to care and pave the way for a term pregnancy for women like Mai. And our FQHC is equipped to do this with the help of the legislation. I could continue with story after story that illustrates this need. I encounter the scenarios on a daily basis. I struggle together with the women and their families to creatively bridge these unnecessary gaps in care as they await their benefits. Right now, it's not uncommon for women who begin with the insurance application process in early pregnancy to still be awaiting their benefits in the third trimester of pregnancy or even as they approach labor. Empowering FQHCs to determine presumptive eligibility for pregnant women and their newborns will remove barriers to essential care, such as prescriptions, testing, ultrasounds, and necessary consultations with specialists in early pregnancy. It's a simple and cost-effective way to pave the way to better health outcomes for the most vulnerable women and their families here in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. And if you could just stay close if there's any questions when we go to questions. Welcome to the other testifier. Did you also want to? Okay, just available for questions. Wonderful. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify to the bill? Not seeing any members. Questions? Not seeing any questions. Representative Zerwas, final word on your bill.
Madam Chair, members, thank you very much. I'll renew my motion.
Okay, members, Representative Zerwas renews his motion that House File 2703 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Thank you to the testifiers.
Thank you.
Representative Zerwas, you have the final bill on the agenda, House File 3044. And Representative Zerwas moves that House File 3044 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Zerwas, I believe we have a DE1 amendment.
I believe we do, Madam Chair. I will move the DE1.
Okay, members, Representative Zerwas moves the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the order that he would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Zerwas, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 3044 was brought forward by the county organizations of MICA, the Minnesota Inter-County Association, MAXA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, and AMC, the Association of Minnesota Counties. The bill would allow the use of interactive video services for certain case management services provided by the counties. With technology constantly improving, House File 3044 is similar to what the legislature passed, allowing for the use of telemedicine. In addition to telemedicine, Minnesota statutes already allow for interactive video use in other situations, including rapid access to psychiatry, collaborative psychiatric consultations, medication therapy management services when there are no pharmacists practicing within a reasonable geographical distance, mental health telemedicine, and other medical services. This bill would allow counties to be reimbursed for direct case management activities when using interactive video services, similar to what they already receive for face-to-face services or telephone contacts. This bill would be beneficial in Greater Minnesota, where transportation and providers are quite limited. And so what we heard is we have instances where you might have an individual that is sent hundreds of miles out of the county for placement, and the county is required to do a check-in on them monthly, which could last just a few minutes. It would involve currently someone driving hundreds of miles in a county vehicle, stopping in, hey, how's it going, checking in, and then leaving. So this would allow some of that check-in to be done through the interactive video. This would not replace all visits, and this would only be done in areas where there's other staff around that if the individual needed to be seen by their social worker, by their caseworker, there would be other folks in the loop, in the care continuum, that could alert folks of that, so to prevent someone from falling through the cracks. With that, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Angela Youngerberg. I am the Director of Business Operations for Blue Earth County Human Services. I'm here today representing MICA, the Minnesota Inter-County Association, MAXA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, and AMC, the Association of Minnesota Counties. Case management is a topic that's near and dear to my heart. It's where I started my career years ago, and I worked with adults with mental illness in the community. When you think of case management services, you think of typical social work services that are provided by the county. What I didn't know when I began my career is that I would spend so much time on the road. I thought I would spend more time with people than I did behind a windshield. I became a very skilled navigator through Minnesota roads, driving to Wilmer, Rochester, Minneapolis, Anoka, Duluth, frequently to see people who are living in facilities with 24/7 care. I would visit them for as long as required, but required by statute and by rule is 20 to 30 minute visit. The good news is that case management
mission is well in hand, and I see that every day in my director role in county social services. I see that case management is producing substantial outcomes in people's lives. Case management is truly helping people live more independent lives. There also have been huge advancements in technology and a societal acceptance of mobile communications, as my 7-year-old tells me every day that he uses this technology to communicate with his family and friends. What I'm sorry to inform you about is that case management as a practice in delivery has not evolved at the same pace. And we are not using technology to practice smarter. We are not evolving to the needs of the current and the next generations. And so therefore, the ideas around this bill were born. We're here today to ask for your support for steps. Steps around a social services policy movement around technology. If we do not change, technology will pass us by. Emerging technologies become old very quickly. We need to engage technology like healthcare has, the private marketplace, and families have. This bill allows face-to-face, phone, and interactive video as options for providing case management services. It doesn't change what case management does as a practice, only how it's delivered. This bill focuses specifically on adults living in facilities and group homes that are staffed by professional staff 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There is consistent professional monitoring of the individuals served. It's a place to start. Counties see that this is cost-effective and it is a time-efficient option. It's a place to grow to. We do not see that there would be any decrease in quality. Participants' choice in this is essential. This would require that the person, the facility, and the home that they live in, the case manager, are all in agreement to providing services and receiving services in this manner. It would have to be outlined in their individual and support plan, and there would have to be significant policies and procedures for the use of this, as indicated in previous legislation around video delivery. This is simply another tool. It's not altogether face-to-face replacement. One of the philosophies that we talk about is that we need to meet people where they are in service delivery. The readiness for services, whether they're ready or not to engage. And I think that this also should include how we deliver the service. A person can opt out of using video at any time. So if they would choose to meet in this manner and then they found it was not their preferred choice, they could go back to face-to-face contacts with their case manager. Blue Earth County and our surrounding counties in our 10-county Adult Mental Health Initiative have extensive experience with video services. We have 36 sites for psychiatric services, for medication management services. We do hundreds of psychiatric visits a month across our counties, across the state, and internationally. We currently provide services to a Minnesota resident who's currently in China. It's always been an option to be seen in the clinic. The choice of interactive video is theirs. We've also seen, in terms of engagement and quality, a no-show rate that is very different when delivering services by video than it is face-to-face. In our mental health clinic, when we deliver services, our no-show rate ranges between 17% and 20%. That's fairly average for outpatient mental health centers. When we deliver the services by video technology, our no-show rate averages 2 to 7%. It's substantially more engaging for our individuals. So therefore, I have no concerns that video will be an unacceptable method to establish meaningful relationships. Briefly on cost. There's no infrastructure funding request as part of this bill. If counties want to do this, want to opt in to providing this service, they would support the implementation costs. When we began providing video services in our clinic years ago, it was $13,000 per unit to set up one individual unit. And, of course, to engage in video services, you need to have two units. And so it was very costly. Nowadays, we set up units for $250. So it's a substantial savings, and that $250 is the equivalent to what I pay one of my social workers to drive to Duluth. So the return on investment for one visit is seen within 1 month's time. Blue Earth County specifically and counties across Minnesota see technology as a necessary investment, and small and rural counties are dependent on this change as they often will have one or two experts in their county of any one social work type, and therefore when they are driving across the state to visit a person, they are leaving their county without the expertise. We have worked closely with the Department of Human Services on this language as well. In closing, human services as a discipline needs a technology platform from which to grow. The state of Minnesota has the ability to do so with policy changes, and local counties can then reinvest resources to do this. But without this change, we cannot go down this path. South Carolina is already doing this. I urge you to allow Minnesota to remain a policy leader in social services delivery systems. To take this initial step, which is years overdue, I ask for your support for this bill, which will potentially open doors for Minnesota to engage its responsibility in blending services and technology to best meet the needs of Minnesotans. I sincerely thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you for taking the time to be here. We appreciate it. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify to the bill? Not seeing any members' questions. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. I can certainly understand you're wanting to do this. So, and I'm not adverse to doing it, but I do have a couple of concerns about it, or at least things I'm kind of not entirely sure about. So the first thing would be, even though this isn't the Finance Committee, I understand that this is paid for through DHS on a, is it a per visit, or could you just sort of explain how the funding works? Because what I'm wondering is are you expecting that the funding would be the same for a video visit as it would be for an in-person visit?
Sure. Ms. Youngerberg. Thank you. Targeted case management rates are established by the Department of Human Services and are administered on a monthly contact. So whether we visit with a person once a month or every day of the month, we receive one flat payment for that. And that payment is the same depending on the type of service and the rules around it, but the payment is essentially the same whether it's face-to-face or telephone, if that is an allowable form of contact. And this bill would allow video technology to replace, not essentially replace, but add to the tools in which to communicate with individuals. So it would be the same rate that is currently being received.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so are you looking at this then as a way to add contacts with clients, or are you thinking of it as replacing some of the contacts? When you were describing it, I was thinking it was replacing some of the contacts with video contact rather than adding more contacts because it's quicker and easier to do it.
Ms. Youngerberg. I think it could be both. The replacing word is one that I don't think is most accurate because it is adding a different type. When a person, for example, if we have someone in Wilmer that we need to go visit and make our monthly contact with, a worker would go generally once a month to go make that contact. They would go more if needed, if that face-to-face contact was required. This could be an option for some of those face-to-face contacts, but not all. We would still have a minimum threshold in which that would be required. But what it also does is it allows easier access to face-to-face communications. So, for instance, if an individual is in a facility and there's a need to have either daily or weekly meetings with a team of individuals, of professionals that work with this person, it's much easier to facilitate a well-rounded team meeting through the use of video conferencing than to have a worker travel across the state multiple times per month. And so while it could increase the number of contacts, we only get paid for one contact essentially, whether we make one or 30. And so it could be an option around access. Yes, absolutely.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so this then includes meetings with team members, not necessarily only with the person. And that right now wouldn't be permitted to do that by video without this bill?
Ms. Youngerberg, with the targeted case management contact, the contact needs to be made with the person. And so we, in order to have a true team, the individual, it's best practices that the individual is present. And so, any kind of meeting by video conferencing could or may not include the individual. Again, best practices would be to include the individual whenever possible. But those meetings are not essentially the same thing as targeted case management. It allows a platform for us to use this as a more typical form of communication, because not every facility has this type of technology. So if we can go down this road for the targeted case management services, we could also use it for those other regular meetings as well.
Uh-huh. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just finally here, I notice in the bill, like on line 4.19, and in one other place it talks about the interactive video is in the best interests of the person. And so I assume from that, I'm just kind of wondering about that standard being in here, because I would think it would be kind of a rare time when having the video instead of the personal visit would be actually in the best interest. Meaning, I could certainly understand that there would be times when it would be okay and just as, and obviously much more convenient, and it might work out to do this by interactive video. But would that really be in the best interests of the person? I mean, does that standard really belong in this? Because I would think that that would be a really rare case where it would be actually in their best interest to have a video visit instead of a personal visit.
Ms. Youngerberg. We could certainly look at that language. The intention around the best interest language was really about assuring that the person, the facility, the home, the case manager, the individual support plan all was in alignment, and that it did meet the needs of the individual. So that language may be finessed a little bit differently. I can appreciate that. I can say from a clinic standpoint, we have some individuals who really are uncomfortable coming into our clinic to be seen because of various reasons. And so I do personally know individuals who do find being seen for their medication management services, which is different than the service, but again, that engagement through technology, they find it much more comfortable to engage through the use of video, because just the process of going somewhere and meeting with someone and being in that doctor's office is anxiety provoking. And so there are a number of reasons why some individuals have found the video technology their preferred method. And if it is their preferred method, I would then say it's in alignment with best interests, putting that person first.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And as always, in dealing with anything in our human service system, there's 1,000 stories and 1,000 places where it might work and places where it wouldn't work. And my fear is that if it's the most cost-effective service, it becomes the dominant service. And, I mean, I've heard from people who have said the only visit they get where anyone really focuses on them for any concentrated period of time and asks them how they're doing and what their goals is their case manager visit. For others, it's the highlight of their life, because I've been told of one that gets transported partway down to Duluth and they get to meet at a restaurant, and it's the only time this person ever gets out. And it's a big highlight of their life to every once in a while get a meal out and be out in a normal setting with someone who cares about them. And so while it's cost effective for the deliverer of services, it may not be, it may not necessarily be a service improvement for the person receiving the services. I have always felt that we should consider seriously, and I don't pretend to understand all the ramifications, but we should really get all of the organizations working seriously with DHS and the advocates to really think about what would it take to blow up our county of financial responsibility laws, and so that people can actually, they're served where they are, We need to develop a service system so people can be served close to home and close to their family members, so that there's no need for someone who is a resident of Blue Earth County to be in Duluth. That doesn't make any sense at all. They should be down in Blue Earth County. And that for us to develop a service system that is actually really person-centered, I think we actually have to commit to that. Instead of continuing to pay people, whether it's on the payroll or you know, mileage or whatever, traveling across the state to go to visit people who are residing in places they don't want to live, far from their family, where their family can't visit them. And it seems like we've created a very convoluted system based on who decided to step up as a provider where, and not necessarily based on where the population that needs the services is. And I would be delighted to work with anyone in this room on trying to figure out how we could get there, because I think we're just spinning our wheels a lot, having social workers and other people traveling back and forth across the state, family members flummoxed in their ability to ever get to visit someone because Greyhound doesn't run to every little city like it used to. And we just have a system that doesn't work for the clients, it doesn't work for the service system, and I somehow think we can do better. And maybe we could even have less accountants, and that might free up some money for some real services or those people on the waiting list. So I'm not opposed to this, although I really kind of prefer more pro-client language in this, you know, limiting it, making it available only to people who have active, for example, family involvement and supports in other ways in their life, or some other limitations that would make it, you know, where it's a check-in by the case manager for a family, for a person who has active supports in other ways.
Okay, members, other questions? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I share some of these concerns. I guess I would be worried that if they were all via teleconference, video, that the case manager wouldn't see the facility or problems with the facilities. And so I would want to at least require some face-to-face visits over a certain period of time, just to make sure that they're overseeing the environment that individual is in.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, and let me just cover the limitations in the bill, because it is limited in scope. The person receiving the video targeted case management service would have to be in a 24-hour staffed facility, so they are being monitored. And Representative Levin brought up the language about the best interest of the person, and also in there it has to be deemed appropriate by the provider. And the use of the interactive video visit has to be a part of the approved individual's written personal service or case plan. So that has to be part of their plan. And then an important part that's actually in the bill for folks to understand is that if this were to go through, not more than 50% of the minimum required face-to-face contacts could be done via this technology visit or video visit. And so half of the monthly required targeted case management visits would still need to be performed by the county of origin in person. And so that connection would still be there at a bare minimum for clients that want to do it this way, with care teams that are comfortable with this way, 6 months out of the year.
Thank you for that clarification, Representative Zerwas. Not seeing any further questions at this time. Representative Zerwas, final word on your bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. With that, I'll renew my motion.
Okay, members, Representative Zerwas renews his motion that House File 3044, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails.
Thank you,
Representative Zerwas. Members, that concludes the agenda for today. We will be back here tomorrow, same time, same place. With that, we are adjourned. Okay.